Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Rob F. from Lansdale.
Hi, my name's Rob, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm nervous. I never get nervous. I don't know what's going on here, but my sobriety date is May 31st, 1985, and my home group is Lansdale Clubhouse Expect a Miracle. Okay. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm from a small New England town. I'm number 10 out of 12 kids, Irish Catholic. My father was an alcoholic. He was 5 years sober in AA when I was born. So AA has always been a part of my life, you know, from drunks at the kitchen table to grapevines around the house. But that was my dad's thing, you know, so I didn't want anything to do with that. And pretty much never wanted to be anything like him. And here I am. I didn't get a lot of attention, as you can imagine, being 10 out of, you know, the 10th out of 12. By the time they got around to the last half, it was feed them, clothe them, get them out the door, you know, good luck, you know. I guess I wanted attention because I found out real early that I could get negative attention, you know. All my behaviors, my addictive behaviors came out long before I picked up a drink. By the time I was 7 years old, I was an accomplished thief, liar, and cheat, and pretty good at it. I was involved in Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, and I was an altar boy. I got kicked out of all of them things. And then I started drinking. I was before a judge when I was 12 years old, and the judge told me then that I should write a book. You know, I was only 12. I hadn't even started drinking. But I did start at 12, and it was the usual, you know, bunch of kids roller skating on Friday night. You chip your money together, you get some Boone's Farm and some Tango, and you know, you drink it till you throw up multicolored stuff, and everything's good. You know, and that's what I did. I didn't start, you know, drinking daily right from then, but I always look forward to Friday night, you know, and that's what it was about. It was about getting loaded. It was never about, you know, having a couple of drinks sitting around and talking about sports or something like, you know, it was about getting as blitzed as I could get. And I ended up doing that for a lot of years. In the beginning, it was nice. I was funny, you know, I thought I fit in finally, you know, after being in the house that I grew up in. I didn't fit anywhere, you know, and it was the first time in my life that I was going to be okay, you know, that I fit, everything, you know, I could talk to people, I was comfortable, I was funny, I did crazy stuff, and everybody loved it, and, you know, climbing buildings or whatever, you know, and that was the lie that alcohol told me, you know, that I was going to be okay now, you know, and I really felt at home when I was in a blackout, you know. By the time I was 16, I was in a lot of trouble, you know. I mean, I was 14, I was before a judge for 17 counts of Grand Theft Auto, because I like to drive. and really, that's really all it was, you know. But they sent me to psychiatrist and everything, and, you know, it was a lot of fun. But what happened was the cop never read me my rights, and I got off, you know. And I got away with a lot of stuff when I was a kid, you know. Even, you know, right up to the end, I just pretty much got away with everything. But that cop didn't like it, so my life was hell from then on in that little town, you know. And everybody knew everybody, and, you know, I was always, you know, dodging something. And when I was 16, my brother lived down here. He had a dinner theater in Valley Forge. And he called my mother one Sunday afternoon just to say hi to his mom. And he said, "How's Robbie doing?" You know, and she told him he's a mess and this, that. And, you know, I quit school, and I was all about getting loaded, and that was it. And I was working I actually got a job in a slaughterhouse, which was, you know, My first job was kind of freaky, but he had me call him when I got home that night, and I called him, and he said, "You got till the next plane leaves to decide if you want to change your life." You know, and that turned out to be my first geographic cure. You know, I didn't know it then, you know, but you couldn't have told me that, but I did. I came down here, I cut my hair, I signed back into school, I went to Methacton School, and I started in September, and by October I knew all the party people, I knew where the parties were, I knew I could get anything I wanted to get, you know, and once again, I fit right in, you know, I felt like I belonged. And I ended up quitting school, and you know, because the girl I was with was graduating, and I was only in, you know, 10th grade or whatever, because I quit. So I figured, why stay there, you know? I quit school, and I was going to join the Air Force. You know, that was my big plan. I was going to, you know, get disciplined and change my life. And, so I did join the Air Force, and I figured I'd see the world and learn all that. And they stationed me in Altus, Oklahoma, and I didn't get any kind of TDY, no travel or anything like that, you know. I had a great job, but I did not have military bearing, you know. I was a drunk through and through. I was AWOL in tech school, and, you know. Well, they called it AWOL. I just called it drunk because, you know, I got loaded the night before, and, you know, I needed time. They wanted me there at 6 in the morning, and, you know. I forgot that I was owned and operated by the U.S. government, you know. And eventually, we parted company. They saw the light, and so did I, you know. Lucky for me, though, the base, the exact center of the base was a liquor store, you know. So, and they knew I got paid twice a month, so they gave me credit. It worked out pretty good for a while. So I ended up leaving the Air Force, getting kicked out of the Air Force. And I got a couple of jobs. I traveled. I had a job as an advance man for a trade show company, which gave me like credit cards and expense accounts, and you know, that was not a good job for me too. And after I got sober, God offered me the job back. I had to say no, because I knew better. But I was pretty good at going from one place to another, and getting a job, getting an apartment, you know, getting a car, a cat, a girlfriend, whatever. And inevitably, I would end up having to leave at 2 in the morning, running from either the good guys or the bad guys, depending on your perspective. And I could do that real well. I did it a lot. You know, I've lived in a lot of places, from Indiana, California, Dallas, Florida. You know, I was able to just go and blend in for a little while until the shit got too thick, and I had to go. I was living in California. It was 1984, and my dad had retired and moved to Florida. And I told you he was, you know, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life was shit, you know, and I knew it. And I went to see him in Florida to give me the big, you know, the little speech that's going to save my life and turn me around. You know, "Dad, what am I doing wrong in life? How do I make this work?" And, you know, the whole Ward Cleaver thing. He was going to sit me down and all the answers would be there in 30 minutes and I'd be good. And I went from California to Florida. I hitchhiked. I wasn't on taking planes or anything, you know. And I got there, and I knocked on the door, and my dad opened the door, and he just looked at me, and I was like, "Dad, what, you know, what's the answer to life, you know?" He said, "Don't drink and go to meetings," and he shut the door. I would have liked to have been inside the house then, because he probably just went back to reading the paper, you know. My mother's like, "Who's there?" You know, they haven't seen me in years, and, you know, my mother opened the door, and I ended up mooching off them for a couple of months, you know, which is what I was pretty good at. I didn't stop drinking. I didn't go to meetings, you know. I thought that was, you know, absurd. I even said that I could get that from the Yellow Pages, you know. I expected something more from my father. And we really had no relationship at that point, and hadn't, you know, ever, really. He was a lot older than me. Well, obviously, but I think he was like 45 when I was born, you know. So by the time I was up and roaming around, he was done, you know. He was ready to go to the beach, retire, and live on a beach like he did. And so anyway, I left there, and I came back up this way, and I got a 2-bit job and a 2-bit apartment and. 2-bit cat, you know, the whole bit. And I swore off the hard stuff, you know, because I figured maybe it's the whiskey, you know, the tequila or whatever. And, you know, and I did okay for a little bit, you know, but I thought I did okay, you know, but that loneliness and the... I just knew I wasn't living right, you know, and I just thought that I knew I wasn't getting ahead, and some of my friends were becoming like, you know, real humans and buying houses and stuff like that, and they weren't, you know, trying to scam people. And by this time, I really didn't have any friends, you know. I had people in bars that would tolerate me until I got drunk enough and they kicked me out. In April of 84, in April of 85, my dad died, and my brother came to see me at my job to tell me about it. And I expected like this big flood of emotion like you see on TV, you know, somebody's dad dies, you know, that's a big deal. I didn't feel anything, you know, and I was dumbfounded by that. So I swore off drinking. I mean, what else are you going to do? Honor my dad, right? On the way to my little shit house in Norristown, I stopped at the bar to tell the fellas I wouldn't be there because my dad died, and they lined him up, you know, and so that didn't work. I mean, the intention was there, and like every other time in my life when I meant to do good, you know, I never meant to be a thief, and I never meant to rip you off, you know, I meant to be nice, but the disease had me, and it was running the show. You know, there was some time there where between the time I was 12 and the time I stopped drinking, where it flipped over and it was drinking me. I wasn't drinking it anymore, you know, and I don't know where that line was, but I think it came in pretty early, though, because there's not a lot of happy memories that I have from my drinking career. So anyway, I went up to Massachusetts. I held a service for my dad, and my family was on one side, and like AA was on the other side of the church, you know. And it was like full of people, and I was loaded. And it was like 8 o'clock in the morning. I was drunk. I was doing drugs right in the same church I was an altar boy in, and. Didn't think any, you know, that was perfectly normal. I'm a grieving son. I'm okay. It's okay for me to do this, you know. And the following month is pretty much a blackout for me. I just got loaded, and that was that. And I was, it was Memorial Day weekend, and the place I worked in a garage, and there was a car that had been repaired, and they weren't going to pick it up till Tuesday. So to me, that meant I had a car for the weekend, you know? So I took this car out and, you know, got loaded, proceeded to do my thing. And I went to bring the car back, and the police were there. So, you know, I'm not stupid. I'm not going to just pull up. I ditched the car. I called my boss's wife, and I told her where the car was. And, you know, she was like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Don't worry about it." I quit my job and all that, and I knew it was time to leave again, you know. But I was tired of doing that, you know. And I went over to the bird sanctuary in Audubon, and I was going to take my own life, which was not the first time I had planned something like that, but it was the first time I had really accepted that it was the right thing to do, you know. And I had a belt around my neck and a razor blade in my hand, and I was stone sober because I knew when I get to the pearly gates, I'm going to have to negotiate. You know, so I didn't want to be loaded for that. See, I'm not dumb. And I had a razor blade in my hand, and the belt was too tight, and I passed out. And I woke up, and it was like 11 o'clock at night, the end of May, so it's still cold and raining. And I was about miserable as I thought I could get, you know. I decided to turn myself into the police, and I hitchhiked from Audubon to Upper Marion. And the guy that picked me up hitchhiking and told me he never picked up a hitchhiker before. It's like a dark, stormy night, right? And he sees me. I must have been, like, really attractive by this time, right? And he picked me up, and I told him my whole story, you know. And he said, "Oh, dude, relax. You're just an alcoholic. Tell them you're an alcoholic and tell them the story, and they'll put you in a rehab, and you'll be fine." I'm like, yeah, that's it. Because I just wanted to ride, you know. And I knew where Eagleville was because I lived in Audubon, and I just knew that's where drunks went to dry out, you know. And that was the extent of my knowledge of AA, you know, even though I had been, you know, it had been a part of my life. So I get the ride. I get to the police station. I go to the front desk and say, "Hey, it's me. You're looking for me. I stole a car." And he said, "I'll be right back." He goes and looks through the stuff, and he says, "Listen, you're going to have to come back tomorrow because we can't find the paperwork." And I'm thinking, yeah, I'll come back tomorrow. But I really had no place to go, you know. By this time, I had been kicked out of the little room I was renting, and I asked the cop, there was a bench in the foyer, and I said, "Can't I just stay here tonight, you know?" And he said, "No." And I'm like, you know, indignant. Now I'm a taxpayer and all this. And, can you imagine? And if I'd have had a half a brain cell, I could have broke something. They would have arrested me, you know. But I didn't think it through that far. Because God didn't want me there. He wanted me somewhere else. Over in King of Prussia, there's an old quarry that we used to party at, you know, when I was younger. And I knew that there were like these caves over there that, you know, we used to light fires and stuff. So I figured I would wait there. And the guy that picked me up hitchhiking told me I had to go to Norristown to get to the welfare office to get the little card to get into Eagleville. That was my new plan. I wasn't about to go back to the cops. Yeah, one shot at that, officer. So I go over to this cave, and it's cold as can be, and I'm wet, and I'm, you know, I'm miserable, and I'm trying to sleep, and this little dog comes by, you know, and I try to get the dog to come up to me for heat, you know, and the dog wouldn't come up to me, and that's where my drinking took me. From when I was 12 and it was the answer to all my problems, to I couldn't die when I wanted to die, I couldn't get arrested when they were looking for me, and I couldn't get a stray dog to come up to me. And I'm so grateful that all that happened to me, you know, because it was the beginning of a new world for me. I didn't know it at the time, and if I had a gun, it might be a different story. I may not be here, you know. But I remember what that guy said, and I went to New Hope Street, and I got the little card, the welfare card, and I went to Eagleville, and I said, "Hey, I got the card," and they let me in. You know, they actually let me in, and they weren't going to. I think it was. Like the end of the week or something, and they had to, they wanted me, they didn't have enough beds, they wanted me to come back, and I said, "There's no coming back, you know." And there was a woman there whose name was Pat Booz, which I got a kick out of. But she seen something in me. And I would imagine it's the gift of desperation. She saw the desperation, and she knew that it was the end of the road for me. And she got me in there, you know, and I thought I had been sober a couple of days, but I spent like 14 days in detox, so I must have been a mess. And then I went into their 30-day program, and then I went into their 6-month program. I was there 7.5 months altogether. And they kicked me out in the end. But so I've been kicked out of everything in my life, except this. And only I can do that. You know? By the grace of God, I haven't found the need, you know. I learned two things in Eagleville, if I had to sum it up. I learned that I could be honest with myself, that, you know, I never even considered that an option with myself. I didn't have to run bullshit past myself anymore. And I learned, don't drink and go to meetings. Same thing my old man told me. And so I did that. I got out of Eagleville, and there were a whole bunch of people that got out at the same time, you know, and there was like a little community in Norristown, which was people, places, and things for me, you know. But I went there and I rented a little room, and we'd all meet at the bus station in the morning, go to our little chumpy jobs, and then at night we'd all meet again and go to meetings. And I went to a lot of meetings in the beginning. I went to NA and AA and CA, and I don't know, there were a bunch of A's back then. And all these people that, you know, there was a lot of, I don't even know where to start with this whole thing. I've seen a lot of bullshit, you know what I mean? Plain and simple. I've seen people that, they told me, I believed all the stuff they told me in Eagleville, that if we care about each other, you know, we can get through this, you know, and that AA started by two guys just talking to each other, you know, and if we were open and honest, that we could have a life beyond compare. And I believed that stuff. And I was seeing people ripping me off, and, you know, I mean, it just wasn't, I wasn't seeing those things, you know. And I had a friend that I met in Eagleville, the girl that you meet in rehab. No, this was different. It actually was. She was one of the most beautiful women I had ever met in my life. And really cool, just, you know, like a dude. It was unbelievable. And we really got along. We got along real well. And my God has a great sense of humor. As it turned out, she was a lesbian. So that whole side of it was, you know, that ain't happening. So what I had to do was learn how to be a friend to a woman, you know, which had never entered my mind before. As it turned out, we were both pretty much like black sheep, you know. Even in the recovery community, it was a challenge. She was diagnosed with AIDS. In like April of 86, and people in AA rooms didn't want her in the meetings, you know. Her family didn't want her at home, you know. Her mother wouldn't let her into the house. That kind of stuff. That stuff that I saw that just blew me away, you know. And I went to my sponsor, who was this old smelly guy from AA. And I said, hey, Herb, what do I do with this? You know, what's this? This is crap, you know. And he said, dude, just go to the meetings and give them resentments. You know? So that's what we did. We went to a lot of meetings and we gave out a lot of resentments. And that girl died sober. And she has saved thousands of people since then. You know, her death has saved many, you know. They wrote books about her and movies. Her name was Gia. And she really changed my life. That whole one day at a time concept, you know. She would say, let's live today because we might die today, you know. And I can't talk to you without mentioning her, you know, because it was phenomenal, you know. To this day, there are people getting sober. They see a story online or they see the movie and, you know, they'll call me or they'll email me and I can talk to these kids about recovery, you know. It's absolutely amazing to me. This is great. I get to talk another half hour. This is how they do it up in Massachusetts. I've been to some meetings up there. I lived up there for a while. Well, let me get on with it. Of course, I met a girl in AA, you know. You know, we fell in love. And I mean, they told me no relationships for the first year, so I waited 13 months, you know. Then I grabbed the first chick and married her and, you know, had babies and all that. And, I mean, that's why that whole, when I hear people say you got to wait a year, you know, don't put any numbers on it, trust me. I mean, they told me that for a reason, and I'm glad that I did wait, you know, but I didn't realize that it's all about, I was immature, you know. I was still a 12-year-old when I stopped drinking, you know. I didn't know that I hadn't done the step work. I didn't drink and I went to meetings, you know, and I say that a lot now, you know. I say don't drink and go to meetings because I know a lot of people cringe, you know. I give resentments when I say that. I don't mind giving resentments. If I give you one, talk to your sponsor. anyway, you know, I was living this life, a happy little life, you know, bought a house, had these two beautiful babies, beautiful wife, and the disease reared its ugly head, and I had to walk away from that. And it almost killed me, you know. And because I had been doing the things that they told me to do and surrounded myself with people in recovery, I made it through that. I didn't shoot any people, dope or whiskey, you know. And I was really amazed at this program, you know, because I had never felt that kind of pain in my life, you know. And I survived that, you know, and I went to, did the whole court and the divorce, and I mean, a lot of you probably are familiar with that nightmare. And I ended up with custody of my two kids, two little girls, you know, and this is a guy that couldn't get a stray dog to come up to him, you know. I didn't tell the judge that, but, but God saw that I thought that I should be the one to raise these kids, you know, and boy, that was amazing to me, you know. I got my girls and I moved back to Massachusetts when they were like 3 and 4 so that my sisters could help me, you know, and that was, it was a beautiful thing. AA is not the same up there, you know, and I thought they were doing it all wrong, you know. I told them. They didn't believe me. It's just different, you know. It was different for me, and I didn't get into it like I did here, you know. They don't have clubhouses, and they're few and far between. And, you know, the first couple of meetings I went to, I saw, like, my biology teacher there, and, you know, I don't want to say too much around him. And, you know, he wasn't talking to me still from 8th grade, you know. So I did. I ended up raising my girls by myself, you know, with help from a lot of people. I mean, I'm not saying that I did it all, but, you know, that just amazes me that this program turned me into a guy that could do something like that. And they're still alive, by the way. Although, I tried to sell them that one time. No. It really was a challenge, you know, and both of my children have this disease. And, you know, their mother is interactive addiction, you know, and they were raised seeing the results of the disease and the results of recovery, you know, and I hope to God that's enough to keep them alive, you know, because this disease, most people that get this disease, that have this disease, die from it, you know. They don't get to come in and recover one time, never mind 8 or 10 or 15 rehabs or whatever, you know. I am blessed, you know. This is truly a gift, this, I mean, think about it. 75 years ago, two guys got together in Akron, Ohio, and changed my life. Gave me a whole new life. I wasn't even born yet. You know, that's a miracle. It's a plain miracle. And you know, it just blows me away. I'm just as amazed today as I was the first day that I didn't have to get loaded today. You know, and that I didn't, like, rob somebody or, you know. I mean, I was out roaming around the city today, had a nice time, a couple different meetings, you know. Never once thought of stealing a car, you know. I mean, simple things like that. I live indoors today, you know, and that's pretty cool. You know, I got blankets and pillows and a thermostat and, you know, refrigerator that has food in it, you know. Most of it's outdated, but it's food, you know. I've had an exceptional life these last almost 25 years, and I can't believe that I got away with it. You know, it's like I robbed a bank and got the money. You know, I've got a backpack full of money. The accountants don't even know it's missing, and I'm walking around spending this money. You know, I really feel like I robbed this life because I shouldn't be dead. You know, I shouldn't even be here. And I know that's true because I've seen a lot of people die that didn't make it, and a lot of people that were a lot smarter than me. You know, that were more devoted to their step work or the big book or 12-step work or whatever, you know, and it would just blow me away, you know, to see them shoot themselves or go back out or, you know. It's really scary, you know. When I was in Eagleville, there was a woman, a therapist, and I don't know if you've ever been there, but they have like an auditorium seating, you know. And there's like a couple hundred people in the room. She said, look to your left, now look to your right, including yourself, that's three people. Within a year, 1 year is going to be dead. Within 5 years, 2 years is going to be dead. And that leaves that third person, the longer he stays sober, the worse the odds are that he's going to make it. You know, and I'm thinking, what the heck kind of encouragement is this? But within a year, both of the people that were next to me were dead, you know? And when I left Eagleville, they stood me in a circle and said, listen, man, you're going to be high in a month and dead in a year. And in May, it'll be 25 years later, I'm still here, you know. And I have, the only explanation I have for that is the grace of God, you know, because I've never done everything perfect, you know, and right. And I just believe this in this program. I know that this is the truth, you know. I got involved with religions and all kind of stuff like that, and you know, there was always some kind of catch, you know, there's a hook, like the 10% or whatever, you know. They would send accountants to me and, you know, come on. You know, but this has never lied to me. AA has never lied to me. It's never let me down. Every time I needed it, it's there, you know, and it's such it's a manual for living, you know. Some people already know how to live like this, you know. I mean, I got sisters that, you know, when they were bitching at me years ago for being loaded, they were saying things that are like, you know, it's the 12 steps, you know. And I didn't know that some people actually live like this already. I thought, you know, I figured they must have done that in school and I skipped that day or something. But it's really amazing to me that I'm even here. I mean, I really. It's that simple, you know. I've never been more intimidated speaking at a meeting than this one. I don't know why. I usually never talk to myself a week before and say, I'm going to say this, I'm going to say that. But I've been doing it, you know, and I don't know why. And I always pray before I speak, you know, God speak through me, and maybe I can help somebody, you know. And that's another thing that blows me away. I can actually help people. I have helped people. And I wasn't about that, you know. I was about helping myself to all your stuff, you know. It was really that simple. I've had experiences in this sober life that, you know, just, it's, like I said, I got two little girls that are now adults. One of them's going to have a baby. I ain't real happy with that, but just, you know, it's scary, scary stuff. And the miracles that I see every day, you know, on a daily basis. I mean, I wish I had some kind of I wish I could package this in a baggie, chop it up, lay it out. I know you'd snort it. Because I'm afraid I don't have any, the magic words that can give you what I got. You know, I can't prove to you that this thing works, you know, but maybe I'm preaching to the choir, I don't know, you know, and I hope I, I don't care if I offended anybody with that. I can tell you some of the things that have happened to me. Well, I live indoors. I like to count that one. That's important. People have done things for me that I mean, I don't even know where to begin. You know, somebody gave me a Porsche. Think about that for a minute. I was a homeless bum, you know, and somebody called me up because I helped their kid one day. Tried to help this kid, and they called me up and said, "Hey, you want this car?" I'm a car thief, you know. What the hell? You know, and I mean, I know people say material things don't matter, and you know, to me that's bullshit because I've had nothing, you know, and I got a lot of cool stuff. But I'll tell you this: I'd give it all up in a minute for my sobriety, you know, because without my sobriety, I have nothing. They asked me in Eagleville, what would you give up, you know? And I'd give up my mother. I'd cut my arms off, you know? And I would, because I know, and I've seen it 1,000 times, if I go back to that, I'm no good. No good. You know, it's not like I'll be able to just, you know, kind of get along with the world and pay my bills until I die. No way, man. CNN's going to be involved with helicopters. You know? It ain't going to be pretty, you know, and I don't want to go there, you know. I don't want to be there. I've been working with this kid lately, and I asked him the same thing, you know, and he said, what would you give up? And I'd give up anything. I said, all right, give me your car keys, you know. I'm going to keep your car for a while. And he gave me the keys, you know, and I'm thinking, wow. I'm impressed. He's never heard me speak. You know, and of course I gave him the keys back after a good amount of time, you know, and I thought he was serious, you know. I mean like 20 minutes, you know. And I thought he was serious, you know, and we started going over the big book, and I gave him something to read, and I said, all right, tomorrow we're going to get together, and we're going to go over this, and I'm going to show you. And I'll do what they did for me, you know, and he didn't show up, you know. I was like heartbroken. You know, because, you know, it ain't about living indoors and cars and all that, you know. It's about living and dying, you know, and I've seen so many people die. And they don't have to die. And that's why I wish I could put it in a baggie or whatever, you know. I wish I could prove to you that this thing does work, because I know that not everybody gets it, you know, and I'm lucky as hell to be here today, you know. And I know I've probably said that about 400 times now, but I really am, you know. I'm blessed. It's a gift from God, you know, and I have to treat it like that, you know, or else I'll lose it, you know, and I have to give it away. You know, I got to find as many people as I possibly can to talk to about this, you know. And I ain't running into bars and all that kind of stuff, you know. You know, but I hang at the Lansdale Clubhouse or any other clubhouse that won't kick me out. And I have a brother who's in recovery and some friends from years ago, you know, and they say, Ron, what the hell are you doing in a clubhouse? You know, why do you go to a place like that? You know, you got all this time, and there's, you know, these people, they're all, they're screwing each other, and they're all still drunk and getting loaded every 3 weeks, You know, that's my job, man. You know, I'm supposed to be there to show them that it does work and you don't have to live like that, you know. As my buddy told me the other day, he said, it's the Willie Sutton theory, you know. That's where the money is, you know what I mean? That's why he robbed banks. They asked him, why do you rob banks? He said, that's where the money is. Why do I go to clubhouses? That's where the newcomers are, you know. And that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm not supposed to just take this and get cars and motorcycles and all that stuff, you know. I'm supposed to give this away, you know, as fervently as it was given to me, you know. And I'm not always good at that, you know, because I don't like a lot of bullshit, you know. Like that kid didn't show up to go over the first couple of chapters in the big book, you know. I didn't call him and say, hey, dude, what are you doing, you know. Attraction rather than promotion, you know. And maybe he'll get it, you know. I mean, I know his mother real well, and I know she's heartbroken over the whole deal, you know. And this is a kid who's 23 years old and had the world handed to him, you know, which was probably his problem, you know. Part of it, anyway. I mean, I look at my own kids, and I always had a hard time saying no to any girl, never mind mine. You know, my one daughter, I got a phone call last Easter, you know, from my daughter, and she had run over her boyfriend. She was drunk, and he said, go ahead, bitch, run me over. I've never said that to a woman. By the time it got to that point, I was long gone. And she did, you know. She was drunk and it made sense. It was the next right thing, you know. And I had to leave my little girl in jail. You know, real jail. She was an adult now, you know. And that's one of the hardest things I ever did, you know. Say no to my little girl. $2,500 would have got her out, you know. And I had to fight the grandparents and, you know, everybody to keep her in jail, you know. No, get a taste. Let this be the end. You know, and by the grace of God, she walked from all those charges and ended up in a rehab in a halfway house. And, you know, I just hope she gets it. I hope she makes it, you know. I mean, I can't get her sober. I can't get you drunk, you know. But it's scary stuff, you know. I try to keep it all basic, real basic for me, you know. The guys that taught me how to stay sober were hardcore, smelly, old AA guys, you know. And they had a lot of time, you know. And they weren't robbing banks, they weren't stealing cars, you know. And I liked that. I said, wow. You know, they had jobs and they had worked careers and... they taught me simple stuff, you know, simple truths. Like, if I don't get drunk, I won't do the stupid stuff I used to do, you know. And it was that simple. And, you know, I needed to hear that kind of stuff, you know. If you live right, right happens, you know. And that doesn't mean that bad things aren't going to happen, you know. But you will intuitively know how to handle them, you know. And those are all truths that I've had in my life, you know. That, I mean, I've had horrible things happen. I was accused of molesting my daughters at one point, and boy, that's a real kicker, that one, you know. I mean, I thought of shooting everybody, you know, and they don't have no Murderers Anonymous, you know. So, but I knew that if I just do the next right thing, you know, the truth will come out, you know, and it did. You know, but it wasn't easy, you know, and I couldn't have done it without you people, you know. My entire life that I've just lived, you know, I mean, I got sober at 25 and I'm almost at that point now, you know, where half my life has been sober, and I couldn't have done it without you people, you know, and I couldn't have done it without them two drunks out in Akron, you know. And If you've never been to Akron, Ohio, just go there, you know. Go on Founders Day weekend because they got a lot of cool crap going on. But to sit in the Mayflower Hotel and feel that buzz, you know, where Bill Wilson decided to drop a nickel in the phone and change the world. You know, it's an incredible place. And I get the chills just thinking about it, you know. I went there for my 20th anniversary, and it was more fun than a barrel of monkeys, you know. I went out on motorcycles with a bunch of other idiots, and we just had a great time. It was a lot of fun, you know. It was one of the best memories I have in life, you know. I belong, you know. I belong there. There's so much I wanted to say, and I can't believe I'm running out of words here. I'm not running out of words. It's been an incredible life, you know, and I could die today and I'm miles ahead, you know. I could never pay back, you know, as much as I try to help people. I could never pay back. I could pay people from here, help people from here till the day I die, you know, and I still wouldn't be even, you know, because, like I said, I should be dead, you know, and I see it all the time that people don't take this serious, you know, or they take it too serious, or they take themselves too serious, you know, and I'm all about having fun, you know. I didn't get sober to be miserable, you know. And I can get miserable, trust me. I'm right there with the besties, you know. Bitching and whining about things, and you know, this ain't right, that ain't right. You know, it ain't right that I'm standing here, you know. I mean, the things that I've seen, I've been asked to leave AA meetings, you know. Of course I refuse to do that. Because that's the one thing I'll go before a judge for, refusing to leave an AA meeting. You think he's gonna let me go on that one, you know? That's a gimme, I think, you know? You know, I've been asked to leave because my kids, you know, I brought my kids to meetings. They were reading, you know, How It Works when they were 5, 6 years old. And that really pisses people off. They used to play, you know how kids like play store or something when they're little? My kids used to play AA meeting. You know? And it's cool that's a good memory for them, you know? Because maybe I planted, you know, I know I planted the seed and I ruined their buzz for sure, you know? It's been an incredible journey, and I just couldn't be more grateful, you know. I don't like a lot of things. I don't like having to feel pain, you know. But they told me in the beginning that pain is the catalyst for growth. I don't know how many times I heard that. And I still hear that old guy saying it when I'm feeling pain, you know. I always wanted the joy of living, you know. I didn't call it the joy of living. I just said, I want to be happy, you know. And I thought I could get it in a bottle. And for a little bit, I did, you know. And then they told me that every time I took a drink, I was covering up my feelings, you know. And I like to think that, that doesn't bother me, you know. I'm not one of them really emotional guys, you know. But I am, you know. I'm a human being. I want to feel everything I need to feel. I want to feel all the pain. I ain't going to like it. I'm going to piss and moan, you know. Because I know that on the other side of that pain is that joy, the real joy. Not the one that comes in a bag or a bottle, but the real joy of living. I've experienced that. I know that that's there. And I know that the more I do, the more pain that I feel, and the more honest I am with myself and other people, the more that joy I'm going to get. You know, so where's the downside? You know, because the pain isn't going to kill me. I've already been dead, you know. It's a powerful disease, you know, and it scares me because I've seen a lot of people lately with 23, 24 years that went out, you know, and I'm real scared, you know. I don't mind telling you. I'm not bulletproof, you know. And I went to a friend of mine who does a lot of 12-step work. You know, he does a lot of the real basic, let's get back into the book and go through it. And I went to him and I said, dude, show me like a baby because I'm scared. You know, and this is not new stuff to me. You know, I mean, I've been reading this book for a long time. You know, but I have to get to that point. I had to get to that point because I know I got a growth experience coming, which is what? Pain. You know, and I don't like it. I had a run-in with pain a couple weeks ago. You know, and I ran right to him. And I went to my sponsor, I said, hey, what do you think of this guy, you know? And he said, do it, you know? And so really, I'm going through the steps like a baby, you know? And it's not going to kill me, you know? And I know that the more I do this, the better I'm going to be, you know? And the better my life is going to be. I can't imagine it being any better than it is today. You know, but back when I lived in Norristown and I had a room and I had boxes for clothes instead of a bureau and a mattress on the floor, I couldn't imagine it getting any better than that either. You know, and it's pretty good now, you know. I see they got a clock here. All right, I got 2 minutes. What can I say in 2 minutes that'll convince you, you know? Don't mess around with it. If you're new at this, get a sponsor. A sponsor is someone who will guide you through the big book and take you through the steps. He's not a person that's going to lend you money, you know, give you a place to live, you know, talk your old lady into letting you back in the house, or vice versa. That's the best advice I can give. Don't drink and go to meetings. Show up, man. You know, show up. Because I know this works. And if you don't drink and go to meetings, eventually your head's going to clear and you're going to hear something that makes sense. You know, and maybe by then, somebody else who needs to help other people will see you and pull you aside and say, hey, I need to borrow you because I got to get better. You know, and the only thing that makes me better is helping other people. You know, and I help other people because it brings it back to me. You know, and I like shit, you know. I like this life, you know. Oh, I've been swearing. I forgot to swear, to not swear. It's all right, though, because my God swears, too. So. Anyway, I guess that's about it. It's 9 o'clock. Thanks for listening.